Two, three. All right, gang, don't say that the Godfather doesn't give you gifts. I've got the grand gifts today. Asra Nomani is here with me. Incredible pleasure to have Asra. Hey, Asra, how you doing?
Oh, wonderful. Great to meet the man who coined the term Ostrich Brigade. I can't believe I'm talking to you personally.
Thank you for popularizing it on Meet the Press. I mean, I can't turn any television show anymore without having you on it. I mean, you're on Bill Maher, you're everywhere. It's wonderful that your voice is expanding. We need voices like you. So I thought we'd start. I mean, some folks might only know you from your recent appearances, but of course you've been engaged in this discussion for a while. Maybe we can go back as far back as you'd like to, but I thought that maybe a good place would be when you try to fight against gender segregation at MAS. Would that be a nice place for us to start?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's always nice to know where people come from. And just so that viewers who don't know me know,
sure.
I was born in India. I was born in Bombay, and when it was Bombay, right. And not Mumbai.
Right.
And in 1965, and my parents are from northern India, the state called Uttar Pradesh. It's a joke, which is that, let's see, that Pakistan can have Kashmir if they take Uttar Pradesh with it. And so it's you know, considered the sort of West Virginia of India, and that's where we ended up in America, is in West Virginia. And so that is, you know, the backdrop to what brings me to the front door of my mosque in Morgantown in October 2003.
Right. So now you went to West Virginia because your dad was a professor who had an appointment there, correct?
Exactly. So my dad was just typical of this entire generation of immigrants from India who came in the 60s and then settled in campus towns around the country from Iowa to West Virginia. And so I ended up growing up in Morgantown, West Virginia, which is just a lovely town where, you know, rolling hills. At that time we had one Dairy Queen. Now we have two.
Whoa, progress.
Yes, we have three super Walmarts, you know, and it was a wonderful growing up. A lot of people talk trash about rural America sometimes, and hillbillies and rednecks and all the like, but I'm proud to have had them among my friends, and I personally grew from it because I felt like I was with the salt of the earth.
Nice. So I should not be thinking of the movie Deliverance whenever you mention Morgantown.
Right. No, you should actually think about it because, boy, we have some creepy woods.
Very nice. Oh, so why don't we start with, so I guess what before we get to the gender segregation of the mosque, what are there any catalysts that you could think of that sort of compelled you to say, hey, I'd like to be engaged in this battle? You know, are there a set of occurrences that led you down the path that you're now currently in?
Well, you know, with the country of your birth, right?
Yes.
The country of your ancestors, Lebanon, I was very, very struck when I was growing up by the civil war that had engulfed Beirut and much of the country. And so when I was an undergrad, I graduated college, class of 1986 from West Virginia University. I'm a mountaineer. And I wanted to go to AU Beirut.
Oh, nice.
For my master's. But there was civil war and there was so much chaos. So I ended up, sadly, going to American University, D.C., not because it was a great education, but it didn't give me that experience that I had wanted. And I was really, growing up, always struck by these issues of conflict, you know, and unresolved grievances and wounds that I want to talk to you more about. But, you know, the thing that all of life is personal, I think. And so the moment that made me an activist and an actual opinion maker on these issues about Islam was the kidnapping and murder of my colleague and friend from the Wall Street Journal, Danny Pearl.
Right.
That was the moment that I knew that as a Muslim, I could not stay silent any longer. These men that had kidnapped Danny did so in the name of my faith. They killed him in the name of my faith. They justified it in the name of my faith. And left back at my house was his wife, Marianne. She was some months pregnant at the time. Danny had left my home when he went for the interview from which he was kidnapped. Marianne had plans to host friends that I had there in Karachi, and she made this amazing Cuban dinner. Danny was supposed to come back for it, and he didn't. And that's really the wake-up call that I had as a human being.
Incredible. You know, two points. One, you may or may not know this, but Danny's father is a famous professor of computer science.
Oh, yeah.
You know that. And I was aware of his work before I knew of his son, because my background, my undergraduate at least, and then in some later studies, I studied computer science and mathematics. And so Judea Pearl's work on something called belief networks, you know, probabilistic reasoning, was something that I had admired greatly and thought that, you know, he was just a brilliant guy. And so, you know, much later down the road, I made the connection that Daniel Pearl was the son of Judea Pearl. I can't remember if I might have even sent him an email once. I can't exactly remember. But I think I probably reached out to him, although my feeling is that if my memory is tight, I didn't hear back from him. But so that's number one. Number two, you may or may not know this, that I've got my own personal history with kidnapping, and that my parents were kidnapped in Lebanon.
I didn't know.
You didn't know that? Okay, so we left Lebanon after about a year of the civil war, because, of course, it wasn't really a good idea to be Jewish in Lebanon at that point. But then when we emigrated to Canada, my parents kept going back to Lebanon for the next 4 years because they still had business there. And I guess they didn't completely get over, you know, Lebanon. They still loved Lebanon. And so they kept shuttling back and forth. And on one of those trips in 1980, they were kidnapped by Fatah. And then they disappeared for, I think it was 8 days. And in the context of that region, when you're kidnapped, the likelihood, probabilistically, of you returning is next to nil. But miraculously, we were actually able to get them out. And of course, as you might imagine, some horrible things happened to them and so on. But we were one of the fortunate ones in that my parents escaped. And incredibly, I just recently sort of realized that I'm currently currently at the age that my father was at when he was kidnapped. So
wow, that's so painful. And, you know, our lives intersect then, because there I was, it was 1980, I was completely struck by the issues of the Middle East and Lebanon and drawn to it. And there you were suffering as a child, you know, wondering. And I know those 8 days, I'm going back in my own brain, because it was January 23rd, Danny was kidnapped, and we searched for him for 5 weeks. And they say that he was probably killed within a week.
Wow.
So I know the peril that you must have gone through.
Now, here's the incredible, thank you, I appreciate your empathy. During those 8 days when they had disappeared, I actually did not know that they had disappeared. I knew that there were a whole bunch of commotion going on in my house. My siblings are much older than me. I have three siblings that are much older. They, I guess to protect me, had lied to me saying, oh, their mom and dad have some business problems we're trying to resolve. Now, here's the interesting part. A friend of the family or friends of my parents who had a son who was roughly my age would see me in high school. Now, he knew through them about my parents. He would see me going about my business, you know, laughing and being happy, and wondering, why is this guy responding so inappropriately to their disappearance? Of course, he didn't know that I was unaware that they had disappeared. So I only found out the full story after they were rescued. So that's kind of an interesting parenthesis to the story.
So how old were you then?
So I was 15.
Oh, and did you feel any sense of betrayal that you weren't told about this, or
that's a great question. Frankly, no. My biggest, if you sort of my most, and maybe there's a Darwinian explanation for this, but my most important sort of concern once they were freed, and this is probably the first time that I mentioned this publicly, is whether they had raped my mother.
Oh my gosh!
And my thinking was that if that had happened, that I would want to go back, you know, and seek revenge, thinking, like a typical sort of Middle Eastern man. Now, my mother claimed that, no, they threatened her in all sorts of ways and did all sorts of psychological trauma to make it seem as though they're about to rape her and so on. But she claimed that she wasn't. Now, I don't know. I kind of asked it once when they came back to Canada, and we never, ever, ever opened the subject again. My dad actually had a scar at one point, a temporary scar, because when the militia came to kidnap him, he held on the railings, begging them not to take him. And with what? One of the machine guns, they hit him over the head. And so he then developed a partial paralysis of the face, like a stroke.
Uh-huh.
So when he came back to Montreal, he had this, what is typical of somebody who suffers a stroke, but then eventually it went away. So it was, I guess, due to the trauma of what they went through and so on. So really an incredible story. So I've seen it all.
Yeah, you have. And, you know, the reason why I think it all connects and connects us also is that you asked me what was the
catalyst,
right? And I think that in each one of us is a moment like this oftentimes. And when you say that you asked your mom once this most shocking of and most painful of questions, but never again, what I've always been fascinated by, and I think, you know, what I want to learn from you is exactly how you have come to understand brain science and all these other ways that we try to process these most painful of experiences. Because I know that for me, there was a part of me that shut down in order for me to try to find Danny. And I've always been fascinated now by that dissociative process that happens within us as human beings that tries to make sense out of chaos. And so I've had amazing, wonderful conversations with Danny's father on this. You know, he's definitely like on three planes higher than I would hope to be about such issues. But the idea of chaos and then trying to make sense of chaos and allowing chaos to exist are all topics that I feel like are relevant to like human drama, like the kind we're talking about.
I could tell you another personal story that speaks to how we repress very painful memories, if you're interested in hearing it. When we left Lebanon, the day that we left Lebanon, we had actually paid some Palestinian militia to come and take us from our house, because to get to the Beirut International Airport, there was no way that you could get to it without going through some roadblocks that were controlled by PLO militia. And in Lebanon, you may or may not know, everybody carried an internal ID card where your religion was stated.
Right.
And so a lot of the butchering that would happen when, you know, a militia group would set up a random roadblock, would ask for people's papers. If you weren't of the right religion, then you were, you know, summarily executed there, right? And so there was no way that we were going to make it to the airport if we didn't have some folks who otherwise might be the ones who are executing us, protecting us, right? And as they're picking us up, you really don't know at that point if they're going to take you to a ditch and kill you. Now, I remember very vividly as an 11-year-old boy, these guys coming over. And I mean, these guys look exactly like you would imagine the ISIS guys today look like, right? With all the guns and the kafir, the whole thing. And actually, one of them made me hold his machine gun. And then as we left, so I have full memory of everything that happened up to we got into the car. Then I have a complete hole. I have no memory until we got in the plane and then we cleared Lebanese airspace. So many years later, I asked my mom, you know, do you remember what happened? And as they tell me, we were going through neighborhoods in Beirut that were controlled by factions that would be, in conflict with the guys who are taking us to the airport. So as we would go through these neighborhoods, it would be basically like Rambo. They'd be shooting at each other. And we were at the bottom of the car with being protected. None of this I remember. I have zero connection to that memory. It was told to me. Even though up to getting into the car and then getting to the plane, I have full memory. There's a complete blank hole for that whole episode. So there you go.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this is the human experience, and the best that we could hope to do to try to move forward in positive ways is have this kind of conversation with ourselves and with our families and our loved ones on trying to be self-aware, right? As much as we can, because our brain does so many tricks, both for survival and for healing, and just in shock oftentimes. And I know that for me, that's the exercise that I'm constantly doing. It's almost like living meditation, right? And it, you know, there's this, behind me are the books on my Buddhist section. And you know, and the idea of insight meditation is this vipassana, and it's about observing your own reality. And I feel like in just being witness like you are right now to your story, that's what we do. And then we gain something from it.
So maybe you could tell us, because I mean, some of the stuff that you're talking about now, would that have been stuff that you would have addressed in your first book?
Yes.
So maybe you could tell us a bit about that. Is that a good segue to do this?
Yeah, you know, and it connects again to everything that we're talking about, because I was awake to all of these realities without knowing you and knowing your own personal journey on that street as a boy. I was so awake to the conflicts and the traumas that were happening in the world, and constantly hearing from my father and my mother this idea within our family that you always have to try to serve humanity. And yet I realized that it's really hard to serve humanity if you don't, if you're not completely in congruence with yourself. And so for me, as a girl growing up in a conservative Muslim family in the West, I was constantly challenged, right, about my own inner beliefs and how I wanted to live my life, and then the messaging that I was getting. And so fast forward, I'm a Wall Street Journal reporter. I've got one of the best assignments that a reporter could ask for, which is to go across the country and explore the big business of selling tantric sex. So I ended up crossing the border to Ottawa to go to a tantric sex seminar by some Canadian tantric experts. And
this is sounding shady. I don't I don't trust some of those guys.
Oh my gosh, totally. Like, not to be trusted. I walked in and to this sort of chalet, and I said, I'll just be observing, thank you. And lo and behold, you know, within hours they have me like playing games with a tangerine that's dangling from a string, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? So I end up doing this interesting story for the Wall Street Journal on page one that explored this big business of selling tantric sex. I found Mr. and Mrs. Tantra of America, and you know, got hit on everywhere that I possibly could go. But I maintained journalistic objectivity, and then I got a book assignment, and that was to go explore Tantra in India. And so I got on the plane, and I first went to Kathmandu, then I went to Delhi, and then the hill stations where the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan Buddhists are living. Learned to ride a motorcycle in India because the roads are so narrow. I thought, if I get a car, like, I'll definitely get sideswiped. So I'm going to buy a motorcycle and learn to ride it. And what was it all? It was all a journey in finding self. I mean, it was a classic Eat, Pray, Love without the movie deal. And I was so bummed.
And without the obnoxious Julia Roberts.
Oh my gosh. And just the storyline was just, my storyline is a little bit deeper, because what I end up, you know, learning is just this existential, quintessential truth, which is that you do have to try to live in congruence within self. And so I would go to these yogis and this and that. I found the Kapafeel Swamis, you know, of the Hindu faith when I would go to these camps, and they were only interested in it for, you know, the action that they were going to get. Right. And then I crossed the border to Pakistan, and I found the Swarmi Sufi saints, you know, who didn't have mysticism quite on their minds.
They had very earthly desires on their minds.
Very. Oh my gosh. I was just like realize the humanity of
Right.
people.
But it's only through exercising their earthly desires could they lead you to the spiritual path that you were on, correct?
Well,
that's what they sold you.
Yeah, exactly. That they were the masters.
Right.
And so I what I saw in those traditions too was the same issues that are in all faiths of the patriarchy, you know, and the man made, let me control women for my own purposes. But what I got deeper was this amazing opportunity to go back to my ancestral village, you know, breathe in the stories of my ancestors, go explore my ancestral land on my own. And at the end of it, I ended up really understanding that we do need to know our own inner truths and not just the messages that we get. And you know, my journey ends then in Karachi, where I'm confronted with the most horrible of moments with Danny's murder. And, you know, the reality of that, the way that they killed him with this beheading and these last words that he was made to utter about his own...
That he's Jewish, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, I have his father's book here, the book that was written, I Am Jewish. And that's when I got just this really deep, deep understanding that, you know, people will constantly try to make your identity, you know, part of their punishment for you, their judgment on you, but that Danny... owned who he was, and then he transcended it beyond this worldly life, and that's what has been my sort of clarion call throughout all of this activism, and you know, taking me to that moment in Morgantown, West Virginia, when I'm standing in front of the front door of my mosque.
And then so that led to your second book, where I guess you recount that battle, correct?
Yeah, you know, the second book ends up becoming my journey into my own Muslim identity. I go, instead of to India for the Hindu and Buddhist pilgrimage, I now go to Mecca for the right. Muslim pilgrimage. Because, you know, in the process of my first book, I ended up having some nice intersections with the Dalai Lama. And he being the wise, happy man that he is, I heard him at one point say, you know, instead of trying to find a new identity in another faith, make peace with that which you were born with,
right.
That which you were born into. And I realized in those moments when Danny was murdered and we learned that he had been killed, that in the foxhole, I turned to my Muslim prayer for protection. And it was in my Muslim faith that I needed to find peace. I came back from Karachi, Pakistan, very disillusioned and very disheartened about the state of Islam in the world and the way it was being expressed by these militants and extremists. And I ended up on this journey with my parents and my niece and my nephew and this great gift that I had gotten. My niece calls my my souvenir from Pakistan, because during the kidnapping, I learned that I was pregnant.
Okay.
My boyfriend had talked about marriage, and we were planning to get married before January 23rd, 2002, when Danny was kidnapped. And then the day Danny was kidnapped, my boyfriend just disappeared because he was afraid that he was going to get caught in the intelligence dragnet. And I understood it because, like your parents, you know, like ordinary Pakistanis and citizens of the world, folks get kidnapped off the streets right. in these countries. And so, but of course, that was probably the best phone call that Pakistani intelligence listened in on when I told him, I am carrying your baby. And he was like, oh, okay, I got to go. So
you never reconnected.
We did. I like, you know, like many many folks, you know, tried the most, you know, tried to put a square peg in a round hole. I appreciate you really talking honestly about your own issue of honor for your mother, because ultimately in our very collectivist societies, honor is such a part of it. And I loved my son's father, and so I tried all through the pregnancy to reconcile this relationship, but with just terrible, terrible pain, because it was a bad, you know, dynamic. And my moment of liberation came when my son was born, beautiful and lovely into this world, and I had postpartum high and elation, and was trying to speak with his father, and I called to Karachi then, and the country code is 92, the city code 21, and I accidentally dialed 911, and yeah.
Now Freud would say something about that.
That it wasn't an accident, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I did it, you know, in the dark of the night, because I was living with my mother. She was and my father. They were helping me bring my son into the world, and I was doing it, you know, as a 38-year-old woman, you know, sneaking a call to my quote boyfriend, and called 911 by accident, hung up the phone, and sure enough, like 911 does, the dispatcher called back and said, "Ma'am, are you okay?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm sorry. I accidentally called you all." And she said, "Does someone have a gun to your head?" And I had my moment. I'm like slow, but when I get it, I finally get it. And I was like, there's a gun, and I've got a gun to my own head.
Wow.
And that was, you know, the kind of peace of inner self that I had been talking about and trying to come to and finally then arrived at. And so do not, you know, live with yourself as you are. Do not live with this idea of shame and honor. And so from that moment, I didn't try anymore. And then he never contacted us. So I've never spoken to him since.
Now, how did your family, so coming from a conservative background, you know, going on assignment to do a book or an article on tantric sex, then having a child out of wedlock, did your parents rise to the occasion, or were they very, you know, punitive in their response?
Oh, not at all. Okay. I mean, yeah, I was afraid to call my parents when I learned that I was pregnant in Karachi, and I told my brother's wife, and she then told my mother, and my mother was so afraid that I had been kidnapped that that's what my phone call was about.
Right.
That when I told her the truth, she was relieved.
That's right. Set up a worse disaster,
yeah,
so that when you tell them the truth, then the contrast effect kicks in and they're happy.
Yeah.
Excellent psychology. Very well done.
Yeah. Not intentional.
Not intentional.
Oh, right.
Right.
But it didn't even matter, because it was love in her heart,
right,
and in my father's heart. It was in Karachi, seeing the way that betrayal expresses itself in the streets, seeing how violence expresses itself, seeing how, sadly, you know, cowardice also expresses itself. I really, really came to appreciate just the core principles that my parents had always taught me of love, kindness, obligation, you know, duty, and that's why I talk about West Virginia so lovingly also, because that's what I grew up around, that, you know, you are true, you are sincere and authentic, and you know, in this grand journey that I'd made to the caves and the temples, the core was right there. The core was in just unconditional love, and that was what my first book was called, Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. And what I realized, and I thought I was going to find it in some, you know, hot guy out there in, you know, Dharamsala, India.
Right.
No, it was like in our hearts, like it's right. in us and it's in those that are around us. And then finally I saw this expressed in this beautiful baby that came out into the universe, and I was his mother. And so my dad and my mom have constantly to this day, my son is 13 now, and you know, they are there for me. If I called them the second, my dad would, you know, get in his Lincoln town car, and it's not a town car, something, or some Lincoln, you know, that right. he's got, oversized the boat, and he would be here. He would be here, you know, within the, get a full tank of gas, and he'd be here.
And so they support, so obviously you criticize a lot of Islamic tenets and so on. Do they support that that quest that you're on, or do you just not talk about it?
Oh my gosh, no. We talk about everything.
Okay.
It's just beautiful because I lived like so many children in any family with that double life, like I was saying, and that is so painful. You know, I ended up like so many youth with issues of depression and inner conflict.
The conflict between your sort of religious background and the modernity of the United States, is that the conflict?
Yeah, on part that was part of it. A part of it was my own idea of what my family's expectations were for me, and so many things like this that were in apparent conflict. And honestly, if you can talk this stuff out, if you can talk about it openly without judgment, without shame, I think that so much anxiety and depression would be lifted. But what happens is that we compartmentalize our lives. You know, it goes back to this dissociation phenomena that we were talking about. Because even to me, immigration and adaptation, those are all things that can bring great trauma to people. And what if we don't talk about it, it just gets buried.
Right.
We don't deal with it. And so that's what I knew through a lot of my 20s and 30s, just this like sort of separate universe. But I came to this point when I had my son, where I'm 38, and now my parents know I've had sex, right? I think it's kind of...
Unless it was divine conception. I mean, it could be possible.
Which was, you know, my grandmother's idea. So she says, she's my dadi, my father's mother.
Right.
So she was a feminist. She was the first in our village to take off the full face veil.
Wow.
Yeah, 1950s. She learned to drive a car in Hyderabad, India, until she hit a rickshaw. And then her days were over, of driving were over. She was like, they said that she was like the Indira Gandhi of our family. She would just go. She was like a politician. And she never, you know, covered her hair. She was quite a feminist. But there she was. It's 2002. I've just had my son. And she's like, Asra, you know, why don't you say it was, you know, artificial insemination? I'm like, oh my gosh, my grandmother comes up with like the 21st century lie. Yeah.
I'm digging the accent, by the way. I like it.
You do, right?
Yeah.
And so I just didn't, I tried during that 9 months of pregnancy to really struggle with what is truth. And I realized that if I live with all this shame and lies and deceit, I will just live with this darkness over not just myself, but my son. And I was not going to, when I saw him so perfect and beautiful emerge into this world, I said to myself, I could not have him inherit shadow.
Right. Wow. What a wonderful testimony to a mother's love.
And my parents' love, because it was they who freed me.
Right. Yeah, you know, the issue of honor and shame is something that I've written about. I wrote an article on my Psychology Today blog about the pathologies of cultures of honor and shame. Of course, honor could be used either as a positive term or it can have also very debilitating consequences, right? So, example, in our tradition, and I'm sure it's the same in yours, it's very, very difficult for people to apologize publicly about wrongdoings. Because that makes you lose face. Now, that's a profoundly unhealthy social dynamic to have, right? Because people who are well-adjusted, generous people, recognize when they make a mistake. Listen, if I speak curtly to my dogs, then I will hug them and say, hey, I'm sorry. Because I recognize that they are sentient beings, and it doesn't reduce me as a person by recognizing that I made a mistake, and hence I'm going to apologize to my dog. But in the context of Middle Eastern honor, it is very difficult, for example, for a parent to ever admit a mistake, right? There's always the sort of the Arabic, I never make a mistake. I'm perfect. I'm never wrong, right? Because to admit that you're wrong to your child is to lose face. And of course, that causes huge problems. And I know from my own personal dynamics with family members, it has caused a lot of problems because I don't subscribe to that. I believe that we all make mistakes, and the right thing to do is to own up to it. But if you are pathologically married to the idea that to ever admit of a failing is to lose face, then it's going to lead you down dark paths. And to speak about something like we were talking about earlier, Freud, for example, the notion of going into therapy is very foreign in the Middle East, because the idea that you would go see the stranger and publicly to him or her at least, admit to your failings. Look, I'm having sexual difficulties in my marriage. I have anxiety issues. I'm insecure. You never admit to that. You'll go to your grave before you admit that. So there are some really interesting psychological differences in how people from cultures of honor and shame handle certain realities, which in the West we consider to be banal and obvious, right? I mean, do you agree generally with this kind of idea?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I lived in the shadow of shame during that entire gestation period for my child.
Right.
And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to survive this world if I continued in that existence.
Right.
And it made me contemplate deeply the impact of honor and shame on our personal psyches. And then it started making me think back to, you know, the pivotal moment when I ended up recognizing the power of owning up. And, you know, my great English teacher in seventh grade, Mrs. Alke, she had given us this journaling assignment. It was 1970s America, and it was just catching on that this was a good exercise.
Right.
And so I would write in there my confessions. There was a TV show called Chips, you know, about the California
the motorcycle guys. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I confessed in there. Oh, wow. Eric Estrada.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You had an Eric Estrada crush too, I think.
Yes. 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 But I haven't come out with it publicly, but now
right?
I have. Now I'm shedding the shame. I am sexually attracted to Eric Estrada. Yes.
Right. So I put all this in, you know, the confessions of a young girl, and I lose my journal. I can't find it anywhere. And so one day it reappears and someone has written into it, "We read your journal and we know all your secrets."
Oh my goodness.
And I suspect who she was, but I won't name her here so I won't publicly shame her.
That is incredibly gracious of you.
Yes, thank you. But that was a moment when I think in my own inner self, I realized it's best not to live with secrets anyway.
Right.
It's best to be transparent and to own up, you know, to all that which is within us, even if it's imperfection and perceived imperfection, because it's ultimately beautiful. It's humanity.
Right.
And that's what I think led me then decades later to write my first opinion piece then in the wake of my son's birth about having him and having him without shame and believing that we have to practice an interpretation of Islam that does not punish mothers that don't wear wedding rings, because at that time they were planning to stone a woman named Amina Lawal to death in Nigeria for the supposed crime of having a baby out of wedlock. And that's what I believe, you know, just like you, I thank you for sharing that about your own family dynamic, because it transcends religions, right? Yeah, and religious identities, the conflicts, right, that it causes, but it's you and your family that then challenge that tribal inherited assumption of honor.
Right.
And then you free your generation and then the future generations, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So now, how do we, so given that honor is so wedded with Islam, by the way, Honor Diaries, the movie which you're, the documentary that you're very familiar with,
yeah.
I will be having Rahil Raza on the show in a few weeks. So I'm getting all of the heroines on my show. Basically, everybody's coming on. So a great honor to have you both on. So how do we get, because what I often see with Muslim folks that I speak to are otherwise very liberal, very secular. I mean, exactly what you'd want Islam to be. Yet when you push them to criticize some fundamental principles in Islam that are clearly there, right? I mean, you could do all sorts of mental gymnastics to try to argue it away. No, you're contextualizing it incorrectly. No, you don't speak Arabic. I do, blah, blah, blah. How do we get those folks to not have the reflex that they've sort of been brought up with, that there are certain things that you simply never should criticize about Islam? For example, Muhammad. I know many very secular, liberal folks that both of us would find sort of the epitome of the liberal, you know, person, that once you start poking there, then all liberal attitudes shut down and they revert to a defensive reflex. Is this something that you've certainly experienced? How do we get over this obstacle?
Oh, me? I've never experienced that. People are like, oh, Asra, you want to challenge our ideas about women in mosque? Wonderful. Let's have a town hall meeting.
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
You want to suggest that the headscarf is not mandatory? Wow, what a great conversation. Yeah, no. As illustrated this past week, this is a serious crisis.
Right.
You know, God, I really want to get your insights into this, because just, you know, over these now, I wrote my first piece about the issue of and sex and having babies without wedding rings in 2003. So now 12 years later, it's been one issue after the next that we've tried to confront, right? The issue of, so this is illegal sex is called zina, right?
Yeah.
In Islam, it's our scarlet letter is Z.
Yeah.
Women's space in mosques, issues of extremist ideology, ideas of whether or not we can have secular governance. And now last week, I wrote this piece for the Washington Post Faith section with my co-author Hala Arafa on whether a headscarf is required, and we argued that it's not. And so indeed all hell broke loose.
Wow.
And in the most distasteful of ways, unfortunately, reflecting to me something that I hadn't really come to believe completely until last week, and that is that we, in fact, do experience a tyranny of thought in our Muslim communities.
Right.
If you dare to challenge the status quo, you might as well be dead.
Right.
And it's not much unlike families that will then disown
right.
a member of their family that has dared to challenge the status quo. But I know that what we have to do is each one of us continue to challenge it
right.
and change the normative. You know, it's a fancy academic term, the
right.
normative, but the normative has to become one of critical thinking and reasoning, because like you, I know in private conversations, people are more than willing to go there, and they need to understand that if we do so in the public realm, there isn't shame in it. Right. There's actually dignity and honor in being able to hold difficult conversations in a civil way. And that's, why does that happen? I think that, you know, we're unfortunately still got this collectivist, yeah, tribal mentality that if you dare to be an outlier and challenge the conventional wisdom, even when you represent the mainstream,
right,
which I believe that this kind of progressive liberal interpretation does represent among most Muslims, then you are ridiculed, smeared, threatened. It's just unseemly. And you know, to me, it all connects back to what we were talking about at the very beginning. Your parents faced physical threat for being who they are when they were taken off the streets. My friend Danny was killed for being who he is. Women, outliers, reformers, conventional folks, people in the mainstream, if you dare to challenge the status quo, they want you to disappear.
Right.
And what we have to do is just really stand up and say, no, our sense of honor is to speak truthfully.
Right.
And that's where the value is.
But so let's get down to the details. So let me give you an analogy from Judaism. So we know that there are 613 mitzvot, commandments in Judaism. And if you are a Jew, you're supposed to, if you take your faith seriously, to abide by all of them. Now, let's suppose we take a kosher law of prohibition to eat pork. Now, that is a Jewish edict that you're supposed to abide by. Now, if I choose, as a person who identifies as Jewish, to ignore that, it's not because I am reinterpreting the text in a way such that it now allows me to eat pork. I am not eating pork despite the Jewish edict to eat pork, right? So my freeing myself of that food prohibition occurs despite my Judaism. Now, let's link it now to Islam. In many cases, you have Muslim folks who are very liberal and secular, but that liberal bent and that secularism, perhaps I'm wrong and maybe you'll correct me, does not come from the text. It comes from those people, like Asra, independently being secular, liberal people. So how is it possible to go into the text and reform them or find new interpretations so that all of the problematic passages could magically cease to exist? Or are we just then playing mental gymnastics and really ultimately the quest of reform is bound to fail?
No, I think that mental gymnastics is a noble venture.
Okay.
I see nothing negative about mental gymnastics, because I think mental gymnastics is us exercising reason and rationality to make sense of historical texts, traditions, inner inherited values, and then reconcile all of that with our current present day. And when I, you know, the verse that most motivates me and inspires me is our see something, say something verse,
right,
in the Quran that says stand up for justice even if it's against your kin. That's a tough, tough verse on the honor shame issue that we're talking about,
right,
because if you stand up against your kin, then this is potentially shaming them. But I believe that, you know, we have this Quranic mandate and to in fact think about the realities and whether we are serving humanity well in the way that we are practicing religion. So, you know, people talk disparagingly about cafeteria Catholics and pick and choose this and that, but that's what religion is.
Right.
I mean, we're just being really, I think, puritanical, really, if we, one, expect people to just follow every letter of the text that we have. And, you know, I'm just pointing over in this direction because this is my exhibit A, you know, and what our problems are, the noble Quran, which is published by the lovely Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Right.
So what what they have themselves done is added into this text and their translation, their vision of an Islam that they want to see in the world. And so everybody does it. You know, people want to hold the government of Saudi Arabia sometimes as demonic, sometimes as sacred. And the truth lies somewhere in between, right? That everybody is working with the text to try to make it compatible with your current day lives. And it's a war of ideas. And so to me, I hope that liberal progressive ideas will prevail as the mainstream. And what I really, really want all liberal progressive people outside of Islam to recognize is that those interpretations that are in sync with their values are, in fact, what they are best served advocating, rather than being part of the ostrich brigade and hiding their heads in the sand and denying that these issues are incompatible, these interpretations are incompatible with their own personal values.
Right.
I mean, it goes back to everything that we talked about related to my own, you know, journey of to find divine love. Like, the idea of divine existence on this earth to me is about being able to find compatibility between what we create out in the world and our inner values. And if liberals and progressives want to really be the change that they want to see in the world, as Gandhi said, see the change that they want to see in the world, they have to work with folks like myself who have values that are also compatible with them. And I think that the mental gymnastics is an admirable way to get there.
But if you forgive me for pushing the point.
No problem.
So are you saying that there's enough semantic wiggle room so that any passage or sentence or edict in the Quran, in the Sirah, in the Hadith can be repackaged in a way that it becomes fully consistent with our shared desire to have secular liberal values? Or are there some passages that there are no mental gymnastics by which we could remove the distasteful nature of the passage, in which case we need to come up with some new means of reform whereby that passage becomes null and void? You have a re-abrogation of passages whereby this becomes not, in other words, you know, to me, I mean, as somebody who of course knows the Quran and the Hadith and so on, there are passages that are simply impossible to reconcile with our vision of pluralistic, you know, liberal secular values. How do we deal with those passages? How do we remove their power so that the folks who want to take them very seriously are unable to do so?
Yeah, like, I think that there's just the Old Testament solution to those kind of problematic passages. You deal with them like we've dealt with the problematic passages in the Old Testament, which is very simple, that they were revealed at a time and place for which they worked, and they don't anymore.
Okay.
And it's that simple historical context analysis that then makes it, in fact, so that you do not practice those passages today.
So that's the tool that you use to nullify those passages. Now, if I am the guy from Al-Azhar University who then says, no, it is the final, inerrant, invariant, timeless word of God, and what you just suggested as the temporal specificity is untrue, what would you say to that guy from Al-Azhar?
I would say, wow, you're so smart. These fancy words, temporal specificity, very.
Those are my words, by the way, but yeah, go ahead.
I love it. I love it. I would say, well, please introduce me to your slaves.
Right.
And hopefully you would say, I don't have any.
Right.
And I would say, well, please tell me how you beat your wife. And hopefully you would say, I don't beat my wife. And I would say, well, tell me, so you don't take any Jews and Christians as your friends? And he would say, oh, no, no, I have many Jews and Christians as my friends. Then I would say, then you are practicing this idea of keeping those passages in the 7th century and not practicing them today.
So by showing him that he's actually not abiding by everything in those books, you're demonstrating his own contradictions. Okay, got it.
Yeah, because that's what life, that goes all the way back to everything that we've talked about, you know, which is congruence. How do you live with congruence? And when you just simply reflect that, actually, I don't take every passage literally. I don't believe every passage is applicable to the 21st century, which has to be the belief of, you know, everybody in the world except for the Islamic State and the Sharia judges of Saudi Arabia, Somalia, Afghanistan, and all the other kind of medieval expressions of Islam in the world. You are doing that. And so when people throw down and say, oh, how dare you? And where's your degree from Allah Azhar to do this? And you know, all of these challenges that act as if we are suggesting something that is just so impossible, I just realize that, to me, those kind of observations are not self-reflective.
Right.
You know, they are living, like you said, with the blinders or the head buried in the sand about their own realities.
Now, in my case, for example, when someone says to me, because I'm, you may or may not know this, although I, of course, identify strongly as being Jewish, I'm also an atheist. Now, some people might say, how could that be? Of course, Ali Rizvi has a book coming out called The Atheist Muslim, right? And the way that I usually answer people is that, look, Judaism has many facets to it. Of course, the central element of Judaism is adherence to a set of religious ideas. But beyond that, there's a shared history, there's shared genes, shared culture. And so I could be Jewish in a multiplicity of ways without necessarily believing in what I call the booga booga stuff, right? The religious stuff. Now, as someone who, I guess you still identify as Muslim, is your Islamic identification similar to how I just described my Jewish identity, or are there elements within the religion that you can't discard? In other words, you wouldn't be as good a person if you did not adhere to those specific Muslim tenets.
Great question. And, you know, I had, going back to what we were talking about earlier, I had a conversation with Danny's father about his own atheism as a Jew, and it was a wonderful conversation. And I think that the atheists like Ali and so many others in our Muslim community that are having greater voice are such a great service to the world. They challenge us and they challenge the universe of Islam in a way that is so authentic and real that they should really be our treasures in my mind. So what do I do for myself? I know that in my parents' upbringing, the values that they taught me within the Muslim context. So when my mother taught me about being serene and patient in this world, she taught it to me through this word sabr, right? Which can also mean, which can also translate as long suffering, right? When women just absorb, accept very difficult situations. But she taught it to me in the context of sabr, that she relayed to me the verses in the Quran that talk about sabr as a virtue and as a attribute. And so that was the way that I learned it. But that was just my frame. And I, what I know and appreciate and respect is that that's just the context with which I learned it. But these are transcendent values.
Right, and exactly.
Yeah, and they're not particularly mine because I learned them through these particular tasks. So, you know, being born Muslim then, I then, for example, accepted this essential truth of being Muslim identity of Muhammad as a prophet, right? Because I've thought deeply, deeply about how it is that that is so radical an idea for people of the earlier faiths, you know, that another prophet comes. Because look at the problem that Muslims have about later prophets that are declared, right? Or that Christians have had about the Mormon prophet emerging.
You're thinking in the Muslim context, like the Ahmadiyya community, right?
Yeah. You know, because and then even the problems that really strict Sunnis will have about the Shia imams that come later, right? And so I think to myself, wow, And that's part of my own inner conversations is, wow, so I really came to absorb this idea of Muhammad as a prophet. But then I also recognize, you know, the greatness of human beings since then and before then who were never assigned that title.
Right.
But you know, there's things like that that I think have just become my inherited understanding
right.
of the universe. But they're just my touchstones.
Right.
That's what I know. That's what I know. And I think, you know, I knew this most deeply that they are transcendent when it came time for me to raise my son
right.
in religion.
Right.
And I gave him the akhika, which is when this tradition where you shave the hair and you give them the Muslim name. And I took him on the pilgrimage to Mecca at 3 months. They say maybe it doesn't count because he was, you know, breastfeeding and
right.
not very engaged in the circumambulation except on my chest and the baby Bjorn carrier. But when it came time to teach him verses as if they are memory, to be memorized and doctrine, I said I can't.
Right.
Like, I chose then not to raise Shibli in, that's my son's name,
right.
In Islam as a doctrine of faith.
Right.
I exposed him to it. I exposed him to all of the faiths, but I did not want him to have to go through that mental gymnastics
right.
himself. I wanted to save his brain power for the exercise of living with those values.
And for studying evolutionary psychology by Professor Saad.
Yes. Oh my gosh. It is his favorite topic.
Is it?
Yeah. When I took him to fencing today, he does fencing like every
right.
good immigrant kid, right? No
right.
concussions in fencing. there was a squirrel that darted. And what Shibli has said to me is, Mom, you shouldn't swerve to avoid hitting the squirrel because you are avoiding the natural order of evolutionary biology. And I'm like, oh, how Darwinian of you. So, you know, we have these conversations. He's 13 now and loves evolutionary biology,
oh,
evolutionary
nice.
Psychology. And that's, you know, what I hope that he can contribute intellectually, spiritually, with purpose and not these great conflicts of inner self. And I feel like it's the greatest gift I could have given him.
So if he were to come to you in 5 years and say, hey, Mom, guess what? I'm not Muslim. I'm an atheist. You accept it, no problem? Or are you disappointed in your inner self?
No, he's already said that.
Oh, he's already said, okay, wow.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You're fine with it.
I chose not to raise him Muslim.
Okay.
And so I'll tell you, I'll let you in on our adventure to Jerusalem.
Thank you.
Yeah, we went to Jerusalem earlier in the year, and we went to the Western Wall. We went, stayed at a nice church community right at the King David Gate. And then I took him to Al-Aqsa, the Dome of the Rock.
Of course.
And, you know, it's like a virtual you know, screening that you have to go through. One time when I went without him, and I had a backpack on, like, you know, signal of foreigner, they asked me my name, they had me recite Surah Al-Fatiha, asked me finally my father's name, and that finally got me in. But on that exercise there that day, Shibli went with me for the Fajr prayer, the pre-dawn prayer, and they asked immediately, are you Muslim?
Right.
And I said, yes. And Shibli went into Dome of the Rock with me. He was so nervous because he said, Mom, you made me lie, and that's against my religion. So I was like, oh, my gosh. So he ended up praying in the wrong direction.
Right.
Because I've had him learn the prostrations
right.
and as an exercise. And people will be scandalized. You know, my detractors will say, how dare she? She has no authenticity. But as a parent, I've decided this is the best path for spiritual liberation and intellectual liberation.
Well, if everybody had your open spirit, I don't think we'd be having the problems in the world that we are. What are some of the projects that you are currently working on that you might want to sort of promote or share with our viewers? Oh,
thank you so much. So I'm so excited that I came together with Raheel, who you will be speaking to. And so all your listeners should definitely tune into that.
Thank you.
And many others. And we've created an organization, an initiative, let's say, not an organization really, but an initiative called the Muslim Reform Movement. Mm-hmm. And in it, we have these principles that we speak about of challenging Islamist interpretations of the religion, especially those that end up advocating violence. We challenge human rights issues like the denial of women's rights, the denial of gays' rights, the denial of atheists' rights. Then finally, we challenge the ideas of political Islam.
Right.
And so what we are all about is advocating for peace, advocating for human rights, and advocating for secular governance. And we're on Facebook. Please go to our page, Muslim Reform Movement, and like us. Please sign our declaration if you believe in these values. We want Muslims, and we want those that we're calling our neighbors, because everybody's got a stake in the fight. And the second project that I've got, that I know that your folks are such great critical thinkers and great investigators. And the next thing that I'm doing is, my next book project is to investigate the Ostrich Brigade. I call it the Honor Brigade, right. Also. The people who do not want us to have these conversations for fear that we are offending the honor of Islam. And a lot of your listeners are going to know who these people are.
Yes.
They're the ones that are attacking all of us.
Do you want to name any of them, or you don't want to give them the light?
Oh, I don't mind at all. I mean, they are, you know, holding positions of academic, quote, importance from Columbia University.
Yes.
Last week, Haroon Mogul came after me saying that we can't have a reform. At Georgetown University's Bin Talal Center, funded by a Saudi prince.
That's John Esposito land, right?
Exactly.
Yes.
He has this young man, Nathan Lean, doing attacks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Doing ruthless attacks on people. And then all the way to UC Berkeley, we have the, quote, Islamophobia Center that detects all of the offenses. And then nationally, we have, unfortunately, the Council on American-Islamic
yes.
Relations, where the Chicago director last week, a man by the name of Ahmed Rehab, said that I was clinically delusional in his argument about why this conversation about the headscarf was not legitimate. And so this is a very, very aggressive, hostile, and dangerous network, I believe, that threatens honest debate in our communities and really threatens, I think, the future of our societies.
Right.
And this great principle of free speech. They attack Ali Rizvi, Majid Nawaz, and, you know, they include everyone from Reza Aslan also, who's going to now be on CNN as a host of his own program,
yes.
to, you know, the cage activists in London,
yes.
who go after everyone. So we're in a war of ideas, and I really want everybody, if I could just urge you to just contemplate deeply everything that God presents to you on these issues, because he is the Godfather, after all.
Very kind and of you.
You must respect everything he says. For fear. And so this, in this investigation, if anybody has any tips or any ideas or any information, please let me know. Email me. My email is public, asra@asranomani.com. Facebook message me. Follow me on Twitter and send me a message. And you know, I think together, I honestly in my heart believe that together we really can win and save the future for our families.
I am detecting that your group will one day be heading to Sweden to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. You are a delight, and I of course could stay with you for another 5 hours, but then it would take too long to upload the damn clip on YouTube. Already this clip will probably take me 6 hours to upload. Hey, Asra, I am so thrilled to have finally had a chance to sit down and chat with you. Stay on. I'm just going to say to the gang to please spread this video and all of Asra's work, she epitomizes the type of voice that we need in this great battle of ideas. Thank you so much for being with us, Asra. Any last parting words?
Yes, I'm going to bring my guest star here.
Okay, show me.
Come here.
I think I know who's coming.
Yes.
Uh-oh, now your prayers have been nullified because you've been in contact with najis, haram to have the dogs.
So as many of your viewers may know or may not know, there is this supposed hadith that says that angels will not visit a home in which a dog lives. Now, how could you possibly look at this beautiful face and think that this isn't the divine expressed right here? And so I just bring her as my testimonial. She's obviously very bored by everything that I'm saying. to say that, you know, this is our future. You talked about sentient beings, and I really appreciated that. That warmed my heart because we have to see the humanity in all, each one of us and in all that lives. And really reach deep into our hearts to reconcile whatever we need to reconcile to go forward with strength and courage. And so thank you, Godfather, for giving me time to talk to you and on all your viewers.
You are so kind. Thank you so much, Asra. Stay on.